In our time in history, when somebody says, let's take a road trip, it usually means a commitment of a few days. Oh, how lucky we have it. When the white pioneers headed toward the West Coast from the middle of the country, they knew they were in for a road trip that would last months. Our guest this hour knew that's what he faced, too. Rinker Buck got fascinated enough with the history of westward migration that he decided to follow in the footsteps of the pioneers, wagon, mules, and all. He tells the story of the journey in his book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker Buck writes constantly and prolifically. It's in the family blood. Rinker's dad was the editor of Look magazine, and Rinker's work has appeared in the Berkshire Eagle, the Hartford Current, Life magazine, and other publications. His memoir, Flight of Passage, from 1997, details another long trip across the country by small plane in 6 days. Rinker Buck, thanks for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Hey, it's great to be here.
You call yourself a history junkie. What kinds of behaviors come with that title?
Well, some of the behaviors belong to my car. For instance, the brakes will automatically apply at historical markers, things like that. If I go to museums, I tend to buy out bookstores. If anybody comes and visits my home in New England, I always take them over to General Sedgwick's grave. General Sedgwick was a famous Civil War general in those days. We don't remember him that much today. And my children groan, you know, because they go, no, Dad. No more visits to General Sedgwick's grave, you know. So it's just a love of history and a passion about it. And also one of the things that annoys me about American history is often the way we teach it is not we're passing on to our children or our students myths, hunches, suppositions about what happened and not really the truth. So, and the truth that you can find from primary sources. So that's what got me engaged in the beginning on the Oregon Trail.
Primary sources mean the records of the people who actually lived in the time instead of the people writing about them later?
Yes, we're very fortunate in the Oregon Trail experience, and ironically that people don't indulge it more, but we're very fortunate in the Oregon Trail experience. The pioneers were very aware that they were making history and that this was going to be an act that would, over time, join America, grow America to becoming a continental giant from coast to coast. And so they were aware how epic this was, and they took careful notes, and the women in particular. It was a very 19th century thing for the wife, the daughter, to be a little bit more educated, a little bit more book-learned than the males. You can't make too much of a generalization of that, but there just were some great, great female pioneer journalists, and we're very fortunate to have their record because it's firsthand. Most of these journals were written. Some of the journals were written much later when they recalled the trip. Those are probably less to be trusted, but many of the journals, and there's over 2,000 of them out there, were written day by day, and you just get this beautiful portrait of, you know, what were the cholera epidemics like? What was the struggle for water like? What did families do when their draft animals gave up or died, and so forth? So we're very lucky in the Oregon Trail in that we can read these firsthand accounts. Many of them are published, and get a real sense of what happened, as opposed to sort of what historians later talked about what happened.
So, Rinker, what were you doing that you found yourself on the Oregon Trail one day in Kansas?
Yes, what happened was I was out working on another story, and I wanted to go see the Flint Hills. Sort of a lover of the West and the landscape, and a lover of history like me, tends to have kind of a bucket list of places you haven't seen yet. So I was in Kansas, and I had a day free, so I went up to the Flint Hills because I wanted to see that old territory where so many Civil War generals got their start. The first frontier forts, Fort Riley and Fort Leavenworth, were there. But instead, I ran into this very large granite marker that said, Junction of Independence Road and Oregon Trail, Oregon City, 2,107 miles, you know. And I said, ooh, let's grab a hat and a water bottle and walk along this. And I was able to walk along the ruts there, and I ended up at a place called the Hollenberg Station, which was the first big trail stop for the pioneers, and quickly became fascinated by the trail and decided to take it myself because I came across an account in one of the history books or a sentence in one of the history books that said the Oregon Trail We've not had a documented crossing of it since 1909. And I have a horse background and grew up on a horse farm and everything. I just said, well, that's a great book. That's a better book than just sitting around a library somewhere and writing it up from that account. So I got this sort of unique amalgam of a book. My editor calls it participatory history. But you learn the history of the trail from the perspective of someone who's actually just spent 4 months riding across it in a real 19th century restored covered wagon. We did one other thing, which was people say, well, were you reenactors? No, the reenactors a lot of times are very, let's just say, they're not up to my standards. Because they'll go on a covered wagon trip for a couple weeks and see a little bit of the trail. But trailing them behind at night is an RV, air-conditioned RV, a special trailer, pulled by another pickup with showers and that kind of thing. And we didn't want to do that.
Oh, so you guys really roughed it then. Okay, well, we'll pick it up there on the other side of a break and get further details about the traversing of the Oregon Trail. In the book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey, by Rinker Buck and his brother, you'll learn, was on the trip as well. Back with Rinker Buck and your phone calls and emails about the Oregon Trail when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the longtime journalist and author Rinker Buck. He decided to take a trip along the Oregon Trail, and not just a little of it, but all of it, all the way from Missouri to Oregon, done the old way, the first people to do it in more than 100 years. His book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 with your questions, comments, and stories of the Oregon Trail, or by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that there are people who've done portions of the Oregon Trail this rustic way, but they generally have, I guess we call them sag wagons behind them, where they would have all the comforts of home nearby. You said next to the sag wagon, huh?
I made a trail pup. I had a trail pup built. It's like a commissary cart. It was a two-wheel cart that we towed behind the wagon. And we were able to carry about 1,500 pounds of provisions and also about 100 gallons of water, which is actually almost 1,000 pounds of water. And that liberated us from having pickups following us and catered meals and all that kind of thing, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with, but that's more of a tourist crossing. It's not a real crossing.
Well, you identified this early on as a, and I'm using your own words here, completely lunatic notion. So, I mean, did you brush it away a few times, or did it solidify right from the get-go?
I think that what happened with me is that I've always been pretty good at denial. And what happens in life, it's so interesting, is we come up with terms like, oh, you're in denial, or this or that, or, you know, you have obsessive compulsive disorder, or you have wanderlust syndrome, you know, you can't concentrate on things. So the flip side of those things is they're wonderful to have. So what I did was I just did a lot of denial. I'd taken a covered wagon trip as a boy with my family, just a short two-week thing from New Jersey, where we had a farm, to Pennsylvania. But it was just like whenever something came up and people said, well, you know, you're not going to be able to get over these mountains here because you don't have support vehicles and you're not going to have the benefits of a big covered wagon train with you and all the labor and so forth that the pioneers had, I just go into hardcore denial. You know, just go, let's see how bad it's going to be when I get there. And the other thing that was good about it was my agent actually said to me before I left, he said, just remember that if your wheels break in Nebraska and you have to walk the rest of the way, you still got a book here, you know. And I was determined to do that. I would have walked the last 500 miles into Oregon if I had to. And at that point, I was very, very steeped in all the pioneer literature and many of the histories. And so I knew that the pioneers got along the Snake, and they were still 250 miles from Oregon, say. before they got to Oregon. And by this time, the wagons were broke, all our draft animals had died and everything. So every time we had a problem like that, I mean, our draft animals didn't die, but we broke our wheels and broke our axles coming over mountains and things like that. I just said, well, this is a real experience. I knew that the pioneers had had difficulties too, and that we would. And the other funny thing about it was my brother and I are quite different. We managed to cooperate and make this trip happen, but we're quite different people. And something would happen, like our wheels would break at South Pass, and there was a thunderstorm coming, and you know, it's all in the book. And it was a pretty perilous day, actually. But I would turn to Nick and I'd go, yeah, but this is going to be great for the book. You know? And Nick would go, Nick, by the time we got to the end of the trail, Nick is like, I hate your book, you know. And a lot of it had to do with, he's a brilliant mechanic and horseman and everything. And so when things broke, he tended to fix them. And I tended to be off in a pickup truck or something, running around a borrowed pickup truck, trying to get supplies or planning the next step. So when things broke, which was good for the book because we had a real pioneer experience, the burden of fixing it usually fell on him.
That's why he hates the book. The book is called The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker Buck is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. What about the particular period in your life made this trip appealing as well as just the draw of the trail itself?
I think a lot of stars aligned together. I had been a print journalist all my life, and it was a glorious and wonderful way to make a living. Print was at its height, you know, when I got out of college in the 70s, and all these wonderful newspapers and magazines sent me all over the world and all over the country. And right up until about 6 or 7 years ago, it was just a wonderful life. I'd wake up in the morning and something would happen in the world or in the country, and they'd say, hey, you want to fly to Utah today and cover this story for a few days? And I love that kind of lifestyle, and I think there's a little bit of restlessness and ADD about me that's fulfilled by that. But print journalism started to die, and newspapers weren't spending money to do that anymore. They didn't believe in quality like they used to because of all the competition from the web. I was divorced. I was a classic divorced guy, you know, running around and partying at night and everything. So for a whole lot of reasons, my life was in need of change. I was a classic pioneer in that way, because when you go back and look at the pioneers and who traveled to the gold rush and that sort of thing, it was often people who were in the midst of things, needed change. They'd run everything to the course, down to the course where it wasn't supporting them anymore. American farming in the 19th century, you basically got a claim to land somewhere, Indiana, Ohio. You farmed it for 7 or 8 years, burned the land out, and then moved on to the next frontier. So I was sort of classically that personality type, and so was my brother at the time, because he'd fallen off a roof and injured his foot pretty badly, and he was now in convalescence. But he was unemployed until his foot healed.
And so at this point, you dove into the research, and give us an idea of the scope and scale of the Oregon Trail migration. I think the numbers can shock a few people still.
It's amazing when you think of the size of the country, which I think was under 10 million at the time. From 1843 until the Civil War, which is the so-called Pioneer Era, half a million Americans, roughly half a million. Some historians say 350,000, whatever, but roughly half a million Americans crossed this huge 2,100-mile trail. It was actually a collection of trails, really, but crossed staying to the river, the Platte, the Sweetwater, the Snake, and so forth. But that's only the beginning. After the Civil War, we then entered the homesteading era. And they were really pioneers, too, but we called them homesteaders because it's forgotten today, but President Abraham Lincoln actually signed in 1862 one of the most important acts of his administration and in American history was the homestead. Act, which was later renewed as the Land Donation Act. And so now you could get free land, including in places like Kansas and Nebraska, Idaho, Wyoming, which were spots that people just passed through. But now those lands are being irrigated with government help and so forth. And So another 500,000 people probably crossed before the turn of the 20th century. But the Oregon Trail also became the Stagecoach route, the Pony Express route. There was no reason to change the trail. It got you west. So Mark Twain and Horace Greeley, when they made these famous Stagecoach rides across the west, were also on the Oregon Trail. The Union Pacific built its lines roughly parallel to the trail because we were anxious to get railroads built quickly after the Civil War. Mm-hmm. And the surveyors went out and they said, well, why should we do all this elaborate work? The trail's there. The pioneers picked the best terrain. Let's just follow that. And they did. And here's how the trail continues to live, and it's a big theme in my book. This is a very organic place. It continues to live and affect American history, as Oregonians know. The route between, say, Portland and Omaha on the Union Pacific, which almost exactly parallels the trail except for a stretch in Wyoming, it's the busiest freight corridor in the world today. So the Oregon Trail did a lot more than just carry about 1 million people west from the 1840s to the 20th century. It also birthed a whole economy for the United States.
It truly was instrumental in a lot of ways, that overland route. We're talking to Rinker Buck about his traversing of the Oregon Trail with his brother Nick. The book is The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Your thoughts are welcome by email as well at jx@jeffnet.org. Marilee in Ashland joins us. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi. I have a question, and it's from my own experience, the question comes. Now, I do have a family that I've got the diaries of their crossing, and they don't talk a lot about the activities in the covered wagon or the wagon trains, simply because I think they're busy taking care of business. And I know that I have a lot of business that I attend to daily, and I have sometimes a great need to write, and sometimes I wish I did more journaling. I know some people were very good at journaling. But the question I wish I had more answers to is how they packed, how we pack. I have a car. I live in my car. I'm trying to get everything I own in my car because sometimes I want to leave. I need to change. I need to go somewhere. There aren't a lot of frontiers left. For somebody that's 68, but it must be my bucket list thing. It's not like I'm running into some big city somewhere. Sometimes I want to get away and go out into eastern Oregon mm-hmm. and find something new, even though it's hard. But anyhow, the packing. I sew bags. I just make bags out of clothing, children's clothes, and I hang them. And I just wonder how people carry their belongings.
Okay, great question. Thanks for that, Marilee. Appreciate it. Rinker?
I love the question because one of the themes of my book is let's talk about the tangible things on the trip that the pioneers took, not these big cosmic issues that historians like to talk about, like manifest destiny and so forth. The ritual of the pioneers packing was that they overpacked. One of the things you learn on the trail is that you can live with a lot less than you think you need. So in addition to all the provisions they needed to make a four-month crossing, which included, bacon and food and flour kegs and all that kind of stuff, which they tended to overload the wagons with and then throw out along the way. People tried to carry a lot of their heavy possessions from home, like an old piano and furniture and things like that. And when they got to the steep hills, and time again, they had to unload the wagon. The teenagers and the children would carry everything up to the top of the hill. The men would have to double the teams and pull up empty wagons and that sort of thing. And do the same thing when you had to lower down the same ridge, the opposite side of the ridge 20 miles later, sort of thing. So what I certainly learned on the trail and what the pioneers learned was that they packed too much. They just way overpacked. And you just need the basic clothes that you need. You just need a couple of cooking utensils. You don't need a whole kitchen. Carrying all your furniture because you think you'll never be able to recreate it again, also a mistake. So people literally, there were families who left Missouri in the spring with a full covered wagon and maybe even towing the cart behind it. And they ended up, after this very, very difficult crossing of the Great American Desert and rocks and lava fields and all this, ended up literally riding their mules into Oregon, and they had nothing left. And so what they were taught and what they taught themselves was that there's an American penchant for thinking you can bring home along with you, kind of like an RV.
Uh-huh.
And they didn't need it. And so I quote in my book a lot these hilarious accounts of pioneers. One fellow named Franklin Langworthy I liked especially. But he would get in the middle of the desert, and there would be a man contentedly eating his lunch, sitting on the carcass of a horse. And it was just amazing what was around. There were boat anchors. There were sinks, heavy sinks, chains, sawyer's tools. You know, someone was a sawyer, and they wanted to become a sawyer out there, so they brought their whole shop. All of that stuff got scuttled. And, in fact, some of the funniest accounts in the pioneer journals are when the pioneers realize after about 100 miles on the trail, they're going to navigate all the way to Oregon, or if they take the California trail branch, all the way to California, simply by following the debris pile.
That's amazing.
So, it's a lot of fun. There's just tons of fun stuff about all the antecedents to America were there. You know, we overloaded and we were bad environmentalists, but then we recycled, you know, I mean, wagons would be abandoned on the trail and everyone would go, great, you know, there's our firewood for tonight. We're going to cook some antelope steaks on that. So it was sort of the hilarity and the contradictions of American life that we see still today. We're all there on the Oregon Trail.
Rinker Buck is the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. You cite the work of George Law Curry as one of your favorite pioneer journalists. Why him?
Well, he was from St. Louis, and he was extremely eloquent. He was a lawyer and a newspaper editor, so he was a little bit more literate and capable of eloquence than say, a lot of the pioneer journals. But the one quote that I used from him that I really liked was, he also reminded me a lot of, he was a self-made newspaper man and lawyer, and both my grandfather and my dad were that, and so he reminded me of them. But I used one quote from him where he talked about what did the pioneer experience do, what did the struggle across the prairie do for you personally, what was your emotional response, and he talked about the creation of strong individualism and an appreciation of just what humanity can accomplish if you want to, and I use that quote early in the book. So that's sort of why he was kind of a favorite.
And he was also Oregon's governor at one point, and Curry County, Oregon, is named for him, which is right in our neck of the woods.
Oh, okay. So you know that? Yeah, that's another interesting point. And there were a number of pioneer women who also became prominent politically and as feminists and socially engaged. The pioneer experience did something to people and drew out their natural leadership qualities. And many of the early governors, just industrialists, very accomplished people, were pioneers. And the pioneer experience produced something in them that gave them quite a future drive in life.
There is that strain you cite in the book about people who talk in terms of like the trail brought out their true nature, got them to be their best selves or something.
It often got them to be their best selves, but let's be realistic here, Jeff. I mean, you know, had a lot of murder on the Oregon Trail. There's one stretch in Wyoming that for some reason, right past Independence Rock, I think it was just, they were in the high desert now. People had been traveling for a month and a half, 2 months. There was a lot of conflict when they crossed the street, when they crossed the rivers. In that case, there was several crossings of the Sweetwater in that area. And everybody's cattle, a lot of the wagon trains pushed cattle along with them, so they had a food source plus so that they could breed cattle when they got out to Oregon. And all the cattle would swim across together at the ford, and then on the opposite bank, the cattle would be all mixed up together. And so all kinds of fights broke out over that.
Oh,
and I describe in the book what this one area was like.
Okay, no fist fights over cattle on this journey, though. Rinker Buck and his brother made it across from Independence, well, from Missouri anyway, to Portland on the Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. His book is by that title. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back from this break, back with Rinker Buck and you and the Oregon Trail in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Rinker Buck, longtime journalist, worked at the Berkshire Eagle, the Hartford Current, Life Magazine, and other publications, wrote the memoir Flight of Passage in 1997 about going across the country by a small plane in 6 days. He went across a big chunk of the country again, this time by something a lot slower than a plane. It was a covered wagon with three mules, his brother, and a Jack Russell Terrier named Olive Oil. The story is told in the book, The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. He did indeed traverse the Oregon Trail the old-fashioned way. You can join our discussion on the Jefferson Exchange with questions, comments, thoughts, memories of the Oregon Trail, stories you've heard. 800-838-3760 by phone, jx@jeffnet.org by email. The trip itself is just boggles the mind what you guys did here. Talk about the involvement of your brother, though, because this is a really interesting communication. You asked for your saddle, I think, is what happened.
Yeah, what happened was we come from a large family, 11 brothers and sisters, and you know, when you get a big family like that and you're always sharing things and doing things together, transactions get complicated. So he had helped me renovate my house, and then at the end of it, I didn't quite have enough money to give him the bonus I wanted to give him. And he goes, "Hey, no problem. Can I just borrow that saddle for a while?" So this horse saddle sat up in his barn for about 20 years. And it was a beautiful Wyoming saddle. And I knew, I was thinking that I would ride across the trail partially. And I now wish that I had a riding horse, because I had to scout ahead on foot a lot to find the trail. So anyway, I sent Nick an email and I said, "Hey, can you send me that saddle back, because I'm going on the Oregon Trail this year?" And at that point, foolishly, I had concluded that I could do the trip alone. And Nick sends me back an email, and he's kind of a working-class guy. I describe him as he always put me in the mood for 19th-century travel, because he has that writing style of a stagecoach driver or a Civil War veteran, you know, the way you read those old letters. He goes, "I'll send you the saddle where or when. Just tell me, this is all one long run-on sentence. Why didn't you tell me, you jerk, that you're going to Oregon this year? I'm coming." And so he came, and it was wonderful to have him. You know, I'm kind of this refined guy, and I consider myself college educated, and I've written books and all this. And Nick, you know, thinks that, you know, college education is just a terrible waste of a mind, you know. You know, it's bad enough that I read a lot of books, but it's even worse that I write them. The division of labor ended up being perfect. I was always a day or two ahead of us on the maps. I knew I had all these books about the graves on the trail. I knew that the graves are really great guideposts to getting you there, because where there was a lot of death on the trail, of course, especially from cholera. And where the graves are was pretty much where the wagons were, because they had to bury people in a hurry and then move on. And so I had all that stuff down, and I was on top of the details. But whenever something broke, or whenever we had a really difficult crossing of a river with the mules or something like that, Nick is just a brilliant horseman and a brilliant mechanic. So it was kind of like this kind of white-collar, blue-collar DNA of our family, that we had the perfect bipolar mix of talents to get us across the trail. And it makes for a lot of humorous reading too, because, and it was fun to write about, because you know we would get somewhere and I didn't think we were going to get the mules over a place called California Hill, which is just 300 feet straight up, and and Nick was sure that he could get the mules over that hill, and you know, he'd say, I go, I don't know, Nick, maybe we should go around and take a detour. And he goes, I'll tell you what, Rink, we're going to try this hill, we're going to get up there. And there's one good thing about this. When we get into camp tonight, and I go, yeah, he goes, you can take your medications. So he leavened the trip with enormous skill base and enormous humor.
That's a good combination to have. Mike in yeah. Ashland asks a key question by email. He says, how did you follow the trail? Were you on roads that paralleled it? Did you have to cross private land? Where did you camp at night?
Okay. The 2,100-mile trail from Missouri to Portland is about half two-lane blacktop, small county roads, sometimes a state road, because the pioneers were going where people needed to go. And so, like today, even if you need to get from Bridgewater, Nebraska to Scotts Bluff, there's a highway right along the ruts. Sometimes you're on a small, what I'd call a farm and ranch road, unimproved road. It's just dust, but it's the closest road to the river that you're following at that point. In this case, I'm talking about the Platte. And then in Wyoming, there's a stretch from Casper, Wyoming, all the way to Cokeville, Wyoming on the Idaho line, where you cross the Rockies, where you go over South Pass. And 350 miles of original ruts, and you can ride the whole way. There were a lot of ranches in there, but some of these ranches, like Split Rock Ranch, where we crossed near central Wyoming, is 37 miles across. It's a huge ranch. And, you know, the ranchers all knew we were coming. It's a National Historic Trail, so we were allowed to be there. And most of Wyoming, I think the stat is 70% of Wyoming is public land. Huge amounts of the trail in Idaho and Oregon are public lands. So you're just riding along Department of Interior, Bureau of Land Management land. And Bureau of Land Management, the BLM, just had no problem with us being there because we had the right-of-way. The laws have never been changed. And a horse-drawn wagon still has the right-of-way on the trail. So it was a mix of public roads, but trail markers right along the public road, and actual 19th-century ruts that are still there that you follow through public lands and vast, very large ranches. The only problem we had that way was there's a lot of fences, and you have to open these fences with these barbed wire gates to get the mules through. We had to undo and then redo all these barbed wire gates so that we didn't let anybody's cattle out.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really rough. The opening and shutting those gates, if there's enough people listening to your broadcast, I'm sure, who know what these barbed wire gates are like, and it was tough.
Yeah, but that's amazing that much of it was still in a semi-primitive state. Let's take a call from Dennis in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rinker Buck, the author of The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey.
Yeah, say, I want to point out something. Some of my family came to Oregon in 1848, and the worst part of their trip that they wrote down and talked about was they came down the Columbia River in dugout canoes.
Right.
And that was so dangerous that everybody just pretty much figured if they made that was the that was it. They finally made it, because every part of the rest of the part of the trip was not really that dangerous, from what I read, from what they said. So I just thought it was interesting that the very most dangerous part of the whole trip was traversing the Columbia River back in the 1840s.
Which is
there were no dams then, and the river was very rough and full of rocks and stuff. So what happened was, after 3.5 months of travel, I get into this in the book, but it was very common. But again, it's something that generally American public doesn't know that much about today. After 3.5, almost 4 months of travel, their wagons were falling apart. There was a stretch where, later on in the trail history, there was a lot of hostile relations with the Indians. Their draft animals had conked out. And so people would get to the Dalles or Pendleton or somewhere in central eastern Oregon and just decide to take the Columbia down because they really didn't have a wagon left. And there were actually boatmen. There were actually services that formed very early, 1848, sounds a little early to me because the trail was only about 5 years old then, and that would mean your forebears crossed pretty early. But it was pretty common to get in a dugout, or they had these bateau boats, they call them. There were services along on the Dalles and other towns where they would take your wagon apart and make a boat out of it, and you just kind of raft down. So it was very common. But yes, it was quite perilous because now you're on a raging river, and the Columbia, of course, wasn't dammed at that point, and the flow was very, very, very rapid. So it was probably the last, I've read some accounts of this too, but probably the last 2 weeks getting across, if you decided to boat the rest of the way down the Columbia to the coast, was the most dangerous part of the trip.
Which prompts a question from Ann in Grants Pass, wondering if you researched the Applegate Trail and wonders if it was really safer than the Oregon Trail. She lives near the Applegate Trail and finds its history fascinating.
Yes, the Applegate, Jesse Applegate and his brothers were, these were two of the earliest men along the trail who kind of transitioned from being explorer types, mountain men type, fur trapper types, to covered wagon leaders. And they, the trail has, the 2,000-mile trail has about 40 different cutoffs and alternative routes. You can take the north side of the Platte, the south side of the Platte, along the Snake River. You could take either side. There was the Barlow Road that went around the Cascades. But yes, the Applegates made, I think, actually a couple of cutoffs that, as I say in the book, the cutoffs became more popular than the main ruts themselves, which is why I discovered that there's many routes that are called the Oregon Trail.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Applegates were they were real originators and did quite a lot to develop the trail because they kept coming up with alternative ways to get there.
Another call from John in Grants Pass. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Rinker Buck.
Hey, thanks. So I have read that one of the leading causes of death on the trail was actually drowning. There were no bridges. They had to ford rivers. People didn't know. Mm-hmm. Back in those days, I'm sure there was not nobody took swim lessons. Is that actually true, that people didn't really know, nobody knew how to swim, and they actually drowned out there? Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm not sure if they didn't know how to swim, but you're certainly correct. I quote in the book one of the great historians of the trail, John D. Unruh Jr. He just plotted 1 year, and there were 90 deaths just in 1 year crossing the rivers. The rivers weren't dammed then. There were ferry services, which later on the trail got better and better, but there was one ferry accident. I think it was at the Lombard Ferry crossing the Green River in Wyoming. 37 people were killed in a single day because they put the whole wagon on this ferry. And if that ferry capsized, which is apparently what happened at that point, and the river was pretty full and moving, the whole wagon just dumped in with all the kids and everything in the wagon, just dumped in the river and was carried away.
Oh.
So the largest single cause of death on the trail was cholera, and I'm pretty sure the second largest cause was drowning. The other complication was there's a lot of quicksand in on the Platte, and also I mentioned before that large herds of cattle were run with the covered wagon trains. And the boys would just jump in with our horses and, try and herd the cattle across. And they weren't used to just how perilous Western rivers are. For instance, the Snake River, there's a Snake River Gorge. The terrain underneath, the riverbed underneath, is as variegated and as dramatic as those big cliffs that you see on top of the river, so above the surface. So there's all kinds of whirlpools and rips and those kind of things. And even today, I only learned this when I got out there, but I was going to go swimming at Three Island Crossing, and they said you don't swim in the Snake around here. Just do not go into the Snake River; it'll suck you right in.
Wow.
So so yes, drowning was wasn't only a big fear on crossing the Oregon Trail. People look back on the horse and buggy day and how dramatic and everything. The accident rates are actually higher than in the automobile age, particularly river crossings, because sometimes they would just lay gravel across the ice, and the ice would cave in, and you'd fall in with your wagon and so forth. 19th century Americans were terrified of rivers because they were so dangerous to cross in carriages and wagons.
So a final question before we go, which is just whether you ended up finding the best part of yourself on the Oregon Trail, as so many other people, or whether you turned into a mass murderer or something along the way.
Yeah, right. It didn't happen to me. But yes, I didn't find myself profoundly changed by the experience. But what's happened is circumstances in my life changed when I got back and finished the book. And I had a need to live in several different places at once to help take care of my mother in Maine and things like that. And I find that I'm much more of an itinerant, transient personality now. The hobo years, the hobo months crossing the trail was so pleasurable that I just like living kind of like a little bit of a refined hobo now.
Well, the journey itself is interesting and very well written about as well. The book is called The Oregon Trail, A New American Journey. Rinker Buck wrote it and joined us today in the exchange. Rinker, thanks.
Thanks. I enjoyed this.
All right. I did too. Take care.